Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. This is episode 34, which we recorded on May 12th, 2017. Politicoast is the podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod.
I'm Scott.
And I'm Ian.
Moving on to segment two, where's the party at? Lost in all the excitement of this last election was the fact that last week Scott Gilmore, the Maclean's columnist and sort of leader of this new conservative movement, was in town here in Vancouver to talk about the new conservative movement and what it was all about. Unfortunately, kind of the logistics were a little questionable through it, and we kind of found out last minute that there was even going to be an event because where it was up in the air. Just wasn't a huge amount of details coming out. It was kind of a little haphazardly done.
Sort of uninspiring for the idea of founding a new movement to not be really able to nail down the logistics of having a meeting. And whatever Evite system he used was just about the worst I've ever seen, because we got dozens of emails every time one person wrote a comment. That, I'm sure, annoyed people, but we didn't get the email when he posted the venue. So luckily, we were looking for it and were able to find it. And about two or three dozen other people, maybe 50 at the peak, also found it. Not as high as some of the other areas he spoke about. I think some of the other meetings had over 200.
Yeah, that's probably a little disappointing, because I imagine your kind of typical Vancouver conservative would be a little more interested in this sort of thing than, you know, maybe, you know, Calgary or the Prairies or someplace like that, where the kind of reform base is a lot more potent.
So we managed to get a recording of the speech Scott gave there, because he sort of did a somewhat off the cuff, but also speech he'd done at all these other places, talking about what he'd heard at different places, talking about why he feels he needs to speak out about the Conservative Party, and even a little bit about the leadership race. It was quite noisy in the pub, so we won't play the full thing, and I'll try and pull out some highlights that you'll hear in a minute. We also then sat around and talked to a bunch of random people who were there, because they all had interesting stories, and I managed to get a few of them to agree to go sort of anonymously on the record, so you'll hear a few random people if those recordings work out well. And then right after, Scott and I here, we sort of sat in the park outside my place when we were, you know, a few beers in and just getting home and wanting to get a stream of consciousness out before we forgot what happened. And so you'll hear a few more drunken words, although I have pre-listened to it and I think it's coherent enough. So enjoy that. And at very worst, those who enjoyed our drunken live show recordings will enjoy drunken conservative recordings.
My name is Scott Gilmore. Thank you for coming. Not only that you were coming, you guys deserve your own round of applause, because you all figured out where this was happening without being told. So, this is clearly the most resourceful people and clever people in Vancouver. Yeah, there we go. This is what I thought we would do tonight. We were expecting far more people, because we thought we were going to tell them where it was, but apparently we decided not to. But because it's a smaller crowd, this is actually much better. This is going to allow us to have a much more intimate and constructive conversation, because that's what I want tonight. It's not me giving a speech. It's me asking you a lot of questions and trying to get a sense of why you're here and what we're going to do next. So this is going to be about three parts to this, if we can break it up. The first part is I want to give you guys a sense of what I've been hearing as I've gone across the country. The second part is I want to ask you some questions to get a sense of who you are, what are the issues, and what are the values that motivated you to come here tonight. And I'm really, really curious to see how those match up with what I heard in Edmonton and Calgary and Winnipeg and Halifax and other places. And then the third part is, so what? What are we going to do about this? If you're concerned about the direction the party is taking on climate change or the direction the country is going, on climate change or gay marriage or whatever it is you think you're passionate about, what are some of the things we can do individually and collectively to make a difference? Okay? So, let's start with this ridiculous cross-country tour. I'm assuming most of you here read that column that I wrote that sparked all of this. Is it? Did you? There we go. Well, if you didn't, there's a couple hands that didn't. The short answer is I was in a hurry to get a column done. Usually when that happens, I just rant. And so I ranted, and then I didn't really have a point, so I said, well, you know what? Let's meet for dinner. If you agree, let's meet for dinner. I honestly didn't think that many people would be interested in having dinner with me. Turns out 2,500 of you said yes. Next line was, I was going to buy the first round of drinks. So, again, I thought I was talking about 6-10 people, not 2,500. But I'm a man of my word. And so, if any of you would like a drink, I would be happy to buy it for you. Okay? Yeah? Good. Just let me know. So in that column, I expressed a few things. I'm being flippant, but genuinely, passionately, there were things that have been really upsetting me about Canadian politics recently. It was sitting in Ottawa, sitting in the bubble. Politics is very, very tactical. It's very, very short term when you're sitting in the parliamentary gallery watching the question period. We see the Conservative Party putting forth policies that frankly aren't in the least bit conservative, they're just anti-liberal, and vice versa. And we see policy ideas that have mostly focused on polling and not on science. And when I was watching the leadership race, I was getting increasingly dismayed. So this was small crowds. I'm gonna share a few personal stories with you that are related to this, because it feels like I can be a little bit more confessional with you, and not with 200. But Chris Alexander, how many people here have heard of Chris Alexander? He's a leadership candidate. So Chris and I worked together in Afghanistan when I used to be a diplomat. And Chris was our new ambassador. I set up the embassy in Kabul right after it fell from the Taliban in 2003. And he was possibly the best diplomat Canada has had in a generation. I mean, no, absolutely. Chris would go out without body armor and negotiate eye to eye with warlords on Catan heavy vessels or heavy weapons. And my job frequently became defending him to Ottawa because he was constantly leading ahead of everybody and doing the right thing and speaking truth to power and making the hard call and pushing for the rights of women and the rights for free speech and all of these Western values that we hold so dearly. His belief was, if Canada is going to be dying on the fields of Kandahar, then we should be getting something from it. We should leave a good legacy. So then, when Chris went into politics, I thought it was fantastic. And then when Chris started to talk about the F-35 and immigration and things like that, I began to think, well, okay, so I guess this is the price you have to pay to be successful in politics. But then when Chris stood up on stage with Kelly Meach in the last days of the election and talked about a barbaric practices hotline, I couldn't figure out what the hell is going on here. Is this some sort of personal self-destruction? And then running for leader, standing on stage with Ezra Levant, while they're chanting, lock her up, about Premier Rachel Notley. This idea that this man who was such a champion for democracy and the rule of law would now be standing on the stage, smiling and laughing as people talk about locking up a duly elected premier in Canada. That's when I began to have this crisis of conscience, because he's a conservative and I'm a conservative. So that means that maybe I don't necessarily agree with him, but we're on the same team. I'm on the same team with this. I'm on the same team with a guy like Brad Trost who won't walk march in a gay pride parade. I'm on the same team with candidates who don't believe in climate change. this increasingly became personally very difficult for me. But at the same time, I'm not a liberal. I believe in the importance of individual liberty. I believe in limited government. I believe in the importance of a strong Canada and strong defense. So now I fall between two stools. And so I wrote this column, and I said, how is it that I'm a conservative, I believe in climate change, I believe in science, I believe in gay rights, and where do I go? So I wrote this column. 2,500 people said, yeah, let's do dinner. They felt the same way. I started in Halifax. And I was very, very nervous about going into Halifax. I didn't know what to expect. I'm not the kind of guy that likes to walk into a room full of strangers and start talking. And I'm definitely not the kind of guy that does it alone. And what amazes me when I go to all these events is how many people show up here by themselves. Can I just see a show of hands of people who showed up here by themselves tonight? Man, you are so much braver than I am. Really, big round of applause. You know, I really hope tonight you leave here with a few friends and a few games, and you stay in touch to make it worthwhile. Thank you for doing that. But what I found in Halifax was possibly one of the most sincere and honest conversations about politics that I ever experienced. And I thought it was really ironic that I had to leave Ottawa and go so far to have that conversation. The people there, very diverse crowd, like this is to a certain extent. There was a fellow there was in his 90s who actually campaigned for Bob Stansfield. There was a woman there in her teens with a hijab. There was lawyers, there was farmers, there was a couple who drove all the way in from Cape Breton. And so I said to them, you know, what are the issues that we should be talking about? And they raised a lot of issues I suspected they'd be similar to you, and we'll talk about those later. But at the end of the night, I said, we're going to have a new leader of the Conservative Party at some point in the next couple of months. What's the one message that you would want to deliver to them? Because I will do my best to make sure that I deliver that message in one way or another. What's the one piece of advice or warning or recommendation you would give them? And they started a conversation amongst themselves. It was a relatively small crowd. And they couldn't quite agree. And then this young lady, clear to throat, Jen spoke for most of the evening. And she said, if I could tell the new leader of the Conservative Party one thing, it would be, don't be a dick. And everybody cheered. They thought that was exactly the point. That's what they all got behind. Because it captured a lot of the anger that they all had about the identity politics, the wedge politics, about the attitude. That, you know, the Conservative Party for a long time here has now talked mostly about fear. They've not been a very negative platform as opposed to a hopeful platform. It's, you know, be scared of refugees, be scared of asylum seekers, be scared of marijuana. And, you know, you see what question period is like. And don't be a dick. I thought that was fantastic. We then went to Toronto. And Toronto, we had about 200 people. I brought on to stage with me Andrew Coyne from the National Post, Sarah Bosabel from Chatelain, Matt Gurney from AM640. And because all three of them are much, much smarter than I am, and much better writers, too, frankly. And I had Andrew talk about a long piece he just wrote in Walrus magazine. Has anybody here seen this piece in Walrus? I really, really encourage you after tonight, Andrew Coyne, Walrus magazine, I can't remember the title of the piece, but he wrote a very long piece about what are the actual base principles of being a conservative in Canada. And then, if these are the principles, how do we go forward and apply it in the policy, and where do they take us? And often, when you go back to first principles, you discover on both economic and social policy that where we are now is probably not where we should be if we really are conservative. So, for example, you know, if you're conservative and you believe in using market forces and small government, and you believe in conserving, then when it comes to climate change, you're talking about probably a carbon tax as the best way to deal with market failure. Or if you're conservative and you believe in the primacy of individual rights, then you also believe that people should be able to marry whoever they damn well please. So Andrew talked about that, and then Sarah Bosabel from Chatelain, she talked about a great piece. Again, take a look at Chatelain. It's not just a woman's magazine. It's actually one of the best political magazines in Canada. It doesn't get enough credit for that. They're really brilliant writers over there. And what she did is went across the country and met with young millennials to talk about their politics, particularly if they were conservatives. And what she had to say that was very interesting is that again and again and again, when she spoke to a millennial, who's a conservative. Do we have any of those here tonight?
Yeah.
What they kept hearing again and again was, I'm tired of having to apologize for being a conservative. I'm tired of telling people I'm conservative and then having them judge me for that. I saw some people replying to that. You feel the same way? Yeah? You know, very interesting. In Calgary, which has to be the most conservative, you know, city in the country, we had a huge turnout there, about 200 people. They said that again and again and again, how embarrassed they were to tell people in Calgary that they were conservative. So after Toronto, went to Winnipeg. Very small crowd, very intimate, and possibly one of the best exchanges of the entire tour took place there. Somebody from the Conservative Party decided to come, which is great. I mean, so when I say from the Conservative Party, like an actual Conservative Party official. And he had come there to set us straight. Because I'm not sure if you've been following some of the rhetoric, some of the response, but you know, I've been taking a lot of heat for setting up these dinners, both in the House of Commons, in the press, people like Stockwell Day, Aaron O'Toole, Ezra Levant. There's been a lot of criticism of this. And so there was a young lady there who was saying that she's sick and tired of the fact that the Conservative Party in Canada is always two steps behind Canadians on social values. They're always playing catch-up. You know, eventually they get there on gay marriage, or eventually they get there on this issue or that issue, euthanasia or what have you. But they always have to be dragged, kicking, and screaming to that point. And so this fellow, castigated her and said, you know what you don't understand is that Canadian values are constantly evolving. And she leaps up and says, that's the fucking point. That was great. This idea that, Canadian values are constantly evolving. And what we believe, even those of us in this room right now, what we believe now is probably a little bit different than what we believed 5 years ago. I can say from my perspective, there are issues like gay marriage. What I thought about gay marriage 15, 20 years ago is different than what I think about it now. And as a country, we're going through those same journeys because new issues are coming up and we're changing what is defined as the center. And the Conservative Party has to start getting ahead of that and not always be dragging themselves behind. So, Calgary, fantastic event, except for the fact that the mic broke and I was supposed to shout and hit everybody. But we got about 200 people. They were talking a lot about provincial politics because they're seeing what's happening with Jason Kenney and the Conservative Party of Alberta being parallel to what they feel is happening at the federal level. And just as an aside, at the end of the night, some of you may have, I told this anecdote to already, but at the end of the night, which I thought had been a fairly successful evening, this elderly couple came up and they literally looked exactly like the couple from American Gothic. I was actually, the internal monologue of myself was, oh, Scott, you're such a stereotyping them as farmers. Well, it turns out they're farmers. And they had driven from Bona Vista, Saskatchewan. And the fellow said to me, I just wanted you to know, we drove 8 hours to hear you speak. And I got to be honest, I missed it up. I was so touched. In honor, these people had read something I'd written, and they wanted to hear me talk about it, and they got in a car, and they drove 8 hours across southern Saskatchewan to come and hear me speak. And so I said, thank you. This is very, very touching. This means a lot to me. I appreciate it. Was it worth it? And he didn't even pause. He looked me right in the eye and said, nope.
Well, just say again, why you came tonight.
Well, I think really what it is for me is I don't feel like I have there's a party out there on the spectrum that really represents what I'm about, what I support. The political figure I'm the most excited about right now is Emmanuel Macron in France, because he's managed to run a centrist campaign. He's a market centrist. He's pro-market, pro-business, putting forward reasonable ideas. And he's managed to galvanize people and excite people. And I think that that's something we lack in Canada, because you have the Conservatives who rely on their base, and they play to the base issue, and you've seen that in the election campaign. And then the Liberals are not fiscally conservative enough for me. And I think they go too far on some social issues even. Like, things that I wouldn't necessarily support. Like, when I think about myself, even as somebody who's, you know, who's bisexual and whose boyfriend is trans, I don't want... For example, I read an article today that the research chairs, they're going to start... They're considering pulling funding from universities if a certain portion of the research chairs are not of a... can't claim some diversity quota. And I don't want that. I don't want a society where we're doing that. And I understand that there are historical issues, but I don't think that's... I think that's the greater issue. The more important one is freedom.
Affirmative action kind of thing.
It's a quota-based approach. Yeah. Exactly. And I think it's the quota-based approach. Because I the affirmative action thing, because I think it's important to acknowledge that it has to do with long-standing historical issues of exclusion, but that the right approach to it isn't to threaten to pull funding and challenge the independence of universities and the apolitical status there, and not to have quotas, not to advantage or disadvantage anybody. It's about running programs like Scott was talking about to foster people. That's what I want to see.
I'm here because my wife brought me to a progressive conservative meeting. She has been very active in the Progressive Conservative Party. She worked for a long time with Kim Campbell prior to her becoming the first female prime minister.
I read Scott Gilmore's article, and it resonated with me. I was somebody who was disillusioned with the Federal Conservative Party on a number of socially conservative issues. And ultimately, I think I'm somebody who is fiscally conservative but socially moderate.
I'd like to see a more progressive conservative approach to the conservative politics that we have in this country. I've been very involved in the earlier days of the Progressive Conservative Party and a little bit in the Conservative Party, but I think that we need to revisit it to get the vote back if we are to defeat the Liberals.
Bizarrely, I came out because my dear friends Ginny and John said, we're having this dinner, it's sort of a vaguely conservative thing, looking at something else, the guy from McLean's, blah, blah, blah. And so I said, sure, I'll come. That's it.
And did you hear anything tonight that excited you or interested you?
Well, the thing that most interested me was the unbelievably difference in the demographics of the people who were here. You know, young people that I would expect to be candidly growing grass in the Fraser Valley to very sort of semi-establishment people here, you know. So it's a really interesting mix, and I found that interesting.
I haven't voted for the Conservative Party, and I think it's because they're behind on social issues, as people have talked about tonight. I think that's ridiculous, and I think it's also a party that's willfully divorced itself from evidence. Not just climate change, but on a host of other issues.
That sort of war on science stuff they got.
Yeah, I mean, climate change is obviously one that sticks out for a lot of people, but, you know, on drug policy or crime, there's a lot of things where clearly the conservative position is the opposite of what every piece of scientific evidence would suggest.
I think that all the parties are fundamentally dishonest and play to the current politics of the day and lie and say things that they don't really believe. And I think that the Conservative Party is particularly bad for that right now during the leadership campaign that they're running. And I'm here because I'd like to see them put forth policies that are more consistent with their stated beliefs and follow through with that. And I'd like to see strong alternatives from all the parties.
All right, Scott, so tonight was, I guess, more your thing than my thing, but what did you think of the overall event?
I thought it was pretty interesting and kind of, I guess, reassured me a bit on a lot of kind of where this was coming from, where Scott Gilmore was coming from, and like one of the big kind of question marks was always the association he has through his family connections with the Liberal Party, and, you know, his spouse is a cabinet minister. But the fact that it wasn't really emphasizing on making a new party so much as trying to find a way to improve the current one, or kind of discussing which are the options, kind of put some of those concerns to rest a bit.
Yeah, that's one thing that really resonated with me, is that idea of just engaging in politics more. And I think that's cross-partisan, whether you're conservative or not. And just the idea of getting involved in campaigns, like when people put up their hand of who's run for office before, that got an applause. And, you know, I applauded as hard as anyone else could, because that's an important thing. And I don't care what party you run for, just the idea of getting, of standing up and running for a political campaign is admirable. And I think he was sort of encouraging that level, maybe not, you know, just stand up and run as an independent, but at least sign a petition, volunteer for your campaign, donate, do whatever it takes, and just get more active.
Yeah. I thought that was good, and the emphasis on kind of becoming a more organized force was good. One of the things I kind of wish we would have, or it would have touched on a bit more, was kind of the, you know, organization's great, but, you know, if you don't have an underlying vision, it's hard to find something to organize around. And, you know, a lot of kind of centrist-ish positions are probably pretty good, but without kind of like an underlying theme connecting it all together, it's a little hard to resonate around and kind of build that. I kind of wish you talked about it a little more. And, you know, he did reference that Andrew Coyne Walrus piece, which, you know, is a good read and everyone should check out, but it kind of would be nice if he fleshed that out a bit more.
You know, both of us sat around with different people throughout the night. What were your sort of takeaways from all the different people you talked to?
A lot of people were broadly dissatisfied with how things are going. I kind of ran into a lot of the fiscally conservative, socially liberal sort of people who are fine with the Conservative Party when they're talking about free markets and balanced budgets, and kind of get pretty turned off as soon as they start talking about gay marriage or immigration.
Yeah, I met with I spoke with a couple people who were sort of either from the Kim Campbell progressive conservative days, or who are more millennial, more younger, but are gay or have friends who are gay or are LGBT or are in partnerships, and just are turned off by the Brad Tross level of social conservatism, which they sort of admits a fringe element of the current Conservative Party, but just the fact it's even there kind of turns them off of big C conservatism.
Yeah, and I've gone to a couple kind of local Conservative Party events within Vancouver, and you do run into quite a few millennials there who kind of have the similar sort of thing. It was actually interesting that this was probably less, or maybe not less, but it was kind of interesting that this wasn't almost as diverse as a lot of those kind of meetings tend to be, which was interesting. If anything, I would have expected the opposite. But you do tend to see a much more mixed group than you'd expect from the stereotype.
Age-wise, I'd say it was actually pretty diverse for political meeting. I've been to a few, even on NDP circles, they tend to skew older. That's just the political engagement. But the racial, gender, demographic was still a bit more male. There were women there, but it wasn't 50-50. And it was a pretty white crowd for Vancouver.
Yeah, and like as I was saying during the thing, like you know, a couple ones I've gone to, you know, especially the kind of Asian community is very well represented at the conservative events, and it was actually kind of interesting that they weren't so much represented here.
I mean, that's something you can think about just in terms of the BC election dynamics. Richmond and some of these rural ridings, especially where the parties are really fighting neck and neck for the immigrant vote, as it were. There are a lot of immigrant communities who are very sympathetic to conservative values. That was something Jason Kenney, as Minister of Multiculturalism, really went after before whatever the fuck happened in 2015, and they decided to burn all those bridges. But the sort of pre that Conservative Party mantra was, let's reach out to these communities, because the strongly devoutly religious people who are moving in arguably are more conservative minded than necessarily
well not only that, like the you know, the sort of people who pick up and move halfway around the world are kind of that, like, hard-working entrepreneurial type who, you know, the Conservative Party can appeal to. So even if you completely factor out the religious aspect of it, there's definitely other aspects that the Conservatives can appeal to on that. So I don't think there was a clear kind of takeaway on where things were going from here, and it'll be kind of interesting to see once all of these wrap up. I think Ottawa is probably the last one next week, and kind of see where that goes and kind of what Scott Gilmore's kind of conclusion of all of this is. And with any luck, we'll get a chance to ask him that later. But in kind of the meantime, it's, yeah, there's quite some interesting conversations, but I'm not sure there was a clear consensus on where we were going to go. And from the sounds of it, it doesn't sound like there's always a clear consensus between the different dinners he's done on where things should go between the Start Up a New Party and Reform the current one.
Yeah. One thing I heard quite a few people talk about tonight was Michael Chong and that sort of idealistic version for the Conservative Party leadership. But then there were also a lot of other people who just weren't involved in leadership at all, which sort of highlights the strength of this kind of conversation and just getting more people involved in politics. But then there was also like a couple other, like I heard a couple of people talk about Maxime Bernier, which I was actually a bit surprised. I was surprised, you know, Aaron O'Toole wasn't talked about stronger, or even Andrew Scheer. Although, well, I guess
those two are kind of very much running off the, things were more or less okay, we just kind of need to just do it better rather than we need to change things. And I don't see the people who would necessarily put them as, you know, choice one or two being the sort of people who come out to this, where both Bernier and Chong have kind of a, we kind of need to change the party in some way, whether or not it's Bernier, you know, full force libertarianism, or Chong's, you know, let's, you know, appeal outside of our core demographics and base.
I think the only other thing I observed tonight is just, and I think Scott Gilmore would agree, is he should not be in charge of this, because he, like, the logistical sort of problems aside, he's sort of the ideas guy, but he admitted himself, like, the fact that people didn't know that this was where, like, the venue got announced last minute, and so a lot of people missed it. There needs to be a different voice in front of it, and that's fine. I totally respect someone who can sort of recognize their limitations, so props to him for that.
Yeah, so you're kind of the outsider on this. Kind of what were your thoughts from the very much not conservative perspective going into this?
I mean, what I told people while I was there, and I was just trying to be honest after listening for a bit, was, you know, I want there to be a reasonable, moderate Conservative Party, like the kind of party where if it's in power, I'm not angry all of the time, and I can sort of get where it's coming from. Sort of like when I read an Andrew Coyne column, I don't always agree, but at least I can understand the logic behind it. Whereas some of the previous conservative arguments have just come from like a pure social conservative ideological base that I reject all of those values. And I like that the conversation that's trying to come out from tonight is more reasonable, more like, let's have a discussion about what are our common values, how can we build a better country that we all agree on and all think would support. I heard a couple people tonight explicitly talk about sort of better evidence-based policies, better ways of coming about democracy. There are a lot of people who are very in support of electoral reform because they just think sort of first past the post pushes all of our ideas to a very sort of narrow range of political expediency. So yeah, I think overall tonight was a positive step forward for at least a part of the Conservative Party, and I hope it can push and pull, or whatever direction it has to go, the broader conservative movement. I mean, big parts of tonight, I sort of smirked to myself because it sounded like, oh, conservatives needed to catch up with liberals almost. Like, why are we so behind on gay marriage all the time and all these other social issues? I was like, well, because it's your conservatives and you're just wrong. But I think the sort of hope there is the idea of being a bit more almost forward thinking on social issues. And I like that idea, and we can have economic debates, and I think those still affect social issues, and there's bigger interaction there. But it highlights the importance of reforming our democracy in a way that allows more voices, because the sort of first past the post is just build a coalition, that ties disparate groups together who don't necessarily agree. Like the social conservatives of Brad Tross don't necessarily belong in the same party as the Maxime Bernier's. Those are very different ideologies. And maybe they both have legitimacy or not, but they are only sort of tied together because they found one or two things that they agree on, but they're radically different parties.
Yeah, all the talk of electoral reform is definitely refreshing. And I also want to add that the talk of kind of parliamentary reform, which is kind of be Michael Chong's big push on the Democratic file, is reforming how it works. And, you know, Scott Gilmore made a good point that, you know, Michael Chong's the rebel in the House of Commons by only voting 99.5% of the time with his party. And that kind of indicates there might be a problem underlying it. And it was refreshing to have that be brought up too.
Absolutely. I mean, that's, you know, across all the parties as a problem.
So yeah, I think overall we were kind of a little skeptical going into this and are cautiously optimistic coming out of it.
I think the biggest lesson of tonight is we need more political dinner parties, which is not the lesson I expected.
Well, and for a final quick segment, a fired storm. The other giant, even arguably bigger news than the BC election this week was that Donald Trump decided to fire the FBI director, James Comey, for reasons that have gone as yet unofficially decided, although most people are assuming it's because Comey is investigating Trump for Russia connections during the election campaign.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, the day we were all watching the BC election come in, the big news broke about Trump firing Comey. And, you know, initially it was supposed to be because he was dissatisfied with Comey's handling of the Clinton emails and that investigation. Although, if that was the case, you know, why is it happening now and not on January 20th? But that quickly changed as the next day Trump did an interview where he basically said he'd already made up his mind to fire Comey before the memo that had come from the DOJ, kind of the, this is why we shouldn't have Comey around anymore because of Clinton emails memo, actually made up to him. And it was just kind of a giant, I want to say dumpster fire, but I feel like dumpster fires are getting a bad branding from all the comparisons to the Trump administration at this point. But overall, it was just being a complete mess. The Trump story has changed multiple times. And, you know, this raises some pretty serious questions about kind of where, you know, the U.S. political and government institutions are, just how resilient they are, because this is a major kind of step over the line on the FBI's independence, the level of political interference they are willing to accept on investigations, you know, whether or not whoever replaces James Comey is going to be basically a Trump loyalist. And, you know, even if he isn't, there's now the implied threat hanging over, well, not only the FBI, but basically everybody else's heads in government that, you know, if they aren't doing what Trump wants, even if they're in a understood to be independent-ish organization, they're, you know, can all be pretty much fired right away. And in addition to that, this also raises some questions about, you know, is this an obstruction of justice situation? Because it's pretty clear, based on not only stuff Trump has said, but kind of the fact that Comey just asked the previous week for a bunch more resources to put into the Trump campaign Russia investigation, the fact that Trump and Comey had discussed it shortly before, or at least according to Trump. And, you know, this is would seem to be on the face of it a pretty transparent case of obstruction of justice, where Trump is deliberately interfering in an FBI investigation to kind of quell it.
Yeah, I don't really have a ton to add on this. I've been trying to keep up and things change so fast. I want to highlight Sean Spicer in the bushes. I don't think I need to say more than that, but if you don't know that story, go look it up and go print off yourself a Sean Spicer mask and start putting it in bushes, because this is fucking hilarious. There's a lot of people following it much closer and much smarter than me who are very concerned, and that's reason enough for me to just sort of almost put up my arms and go, this is bad. And when we say Trump's not normal, this is the kind of shit we're talking about. I'll just throw out recommendations. Go listen to Pod Save America. Go listen to Slate Political Babfest. Vox is the Weeds probably has a couple episodes on this. There's tons of analysis everywhere, just freaking out, trying to figure out what's going on. And will this be the start of the end of Trump? I don't think so, because it seems like the Republicans still like him for whatever reason, because some chunk of the American electorate does.
I think something there's going to eventually have to give, and you know, it might not be any one thing, but like this is one of those big things that I think the more, at the very least, the more principled members of the Republican caucus have got to be asking themselves privately about, and kind of amongst each other, if not in the press at the moment, how much longer they can kind of go along with this sort of thing. And as basically seems like every hour some new detail or aspect of the story comes out, and there's been a lot of leaks. The Washington Post put out a story where they had 30 anonymous sources from within the government basically all come out and confirm a whole bunch of stuff in a very short amount of time. And there's,
well, that's been the sort of growing almost source measuring competition of the major newspapers in the US. It's just like, how many anonymous sources can you get per story? And they're just sort of showing off now. But it also confirms that this is happening.
Yeah, and there's kind of a lot of expectations among the kind of US pundit class that there's a good chance we're going to start seeing a bunch more leaks coming out of the FBI that are going to be kind of embarrassing to Trump in kind of a slight retaliation, slight, hey, we really value our independence and stop fucking around with us, and we're kind of drawing a line in the sand. If you want to sandbag this investigation, we'll make sure it seeps out. And as more of that stuff kind of comes out, I think the chances that prominent Republicans, and especially the ones who kind of are a little more principled, even if they don't play that role on TV very well, some of them, I think, are going to start seriously thinking about kind of defecting. And once that situation happens, I think we'll start to see a few more breaks in kind of the wall of Trump support that is the Republican Congressional Caucus start to fracture and kind of come apart. And you know, this might not be the thing that Trump gets impeached on, but at the very least, I think it's a pretty big crack in the wall. So yeah, this is just something we're going to have to follow closely. And, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if when we're done recording this and check the news, like three other major breaks have happened in the story. And, you know, the whole situation just completely changed yet again.
Well, the one thing going for us is this time we're actually recording on a Friday night, and I'll hopefully have this up by midday Saturday. So that's not usually when big news stories break of people doing things, because politicians have weekends too.
This isn't a usual week, yeah, for sure.
This isn't a usual presidency, for sure.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicoast.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at PoliticoastPod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. And if you have any ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.